Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. We're taking a look at some of the issues that are on the agenda as the legislature reconvenes in Montpelier this year. We've just finished discussing the paid sick leave bill, and now we're going to turn to a variety of issues that relate to civil liberties. And here to talk about that, we welcome back Alan Gilbert, the executive director of the Vermont chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Alan, welcome back to the Vermont Conversation.
Hi, happy to be here.
So we have news involving issues that you've been involved in breaking at least daily at the moment, if not hourly. Let's talk for a moment about the deal that was struck yesterday around Act 46 spending caps. And why don't we kind of take it from the start, explain what these spending caps are and why the ACLU is involved.
So the spending caps in Act 46 require that a school stay within a cap assigned specifically to it based on its spending of the previous year and where it is in spending relative to all other schools. If you're a high-spending school district, this is spending per pupil, you have less room to grow, like 0.5% or less. If you're a low-spending district, you have a higher percentage to grow, maybe 5%. The problem is that this system violates the basic equity provision of the Brigham decision that was that was issued by the Vermont Supreme Court in 1997. The Supreme Court said at that time all towns must have an equal draw on school resources, school funds, to fund their schools. This violates that. As an example, if the town of Irisburg, which spends about $11,000 per pupil, wanted to spend as much as the town of Danby, which spends about $18,000 per pupil, it would pay a premium of almost $1 million to be able to spend the same amount. That is a violation of Brigham straight up, and we have said consistently since the bill was passed and signed by the governor that the caps really should go. Otherwise, the bill, this particular provision, has a serious constitutional deficiency.
And, of course, we heard last week in Governor Shumlin's State of the State address, he called for an outright repeal of the spending caps. Is that what you're calling for as well?
Yeah, we are. We think they should be repealed. The House, so far the House Education Committee, has been reluctant to do that. Yesterday they agreed to adjust them slightly to try to take into account the large increase in teacher health insurance premiums. But the problem is that people don't realize some of the crazy consequences of the way this law is working. Yesterday, the committee realized for what appeared to be the first time that it actually might be the highest spending districts that see the biggest tax increases this year, that a high spending district might see their school tax rate fall more than a low spending district. And nobody had really thought about that, but when you do the reverse logic on how money flows through the system, it's exactly an example of the inequity that we feel is in the law and has got to be eliminated.
So one of the things that we hear supporters of the spending caps say is that it is the only mechanism to restrain spending increases in the schools, and if you remove it, you lose the only stick you have. How do you respond to that?
Well, there are lots of different ways that you could enforce cost containment measures on schools. There has been one in place for I think 4 or 5 years, and that's what used to be called, well, still is called, it's still in the books, although suspended for the moment, the excess spending thresholds. When a school spent above a certain percentage, say 125% of the statewide average, they were taxed at a slightly higher rate than other schools. That worked to a small extent because there were some schools that were getting up into that threshold penalty level. But that's a much more equitable way of doing it because you set a public policy goal of trying to tamp down school spending by telling those at the very, very top they really do have to spend less because they're draining too much money out of the system for other people. We did not oppose the excess spending thresholds, and that was what was in this bill when it was going through the House and went to the conference committee. The excess spending thresholds were going to be lowered, and that was going to act as the brake on excess spending by schools. And we think actually that system would have worked better, and it certainly would have been fairer.
So with the excess spending threshold, what happens when you cross that threshold again? Remind us.
You are penalized, and I think instead of the 100% penalty that's in the Act 46 caps provision, I think an extra 25% was tacked onto your spending above the threshold.
And then there was another provision that required simply a second vote by your community if you exceeded a certain threshold.
Yeah, and I don't think that actually ever happened, and it might have been repealed after a couple of years. I can't remember. And I must admit, I was on the school board at that time, and now I can't remember the details of how the two-vote measure worked.
I recall it sunsetted. It was a temporary mechanism to, if you exceeded a threshold, it simply required you to have a second vote approving whatever amount was over the threshold. So there have been various attempts at this. So talk about what happened in the Education Committee yesterday as they went to reconsider and how this changes it. They raised the spending cap level, but what is that in practice? What does that do?
In practice, it gives a little bit more room for school districts. 0.9% is what the cap was raised. It basically is supposed to cover the excess unanticipated higher health insurance premiums that schools will have to pay this coming year. So it was not supposed to lighten any other load other than that unanticipated extra load of the health insurance premiums. One of the problems by doing this, however, is that health insurance is not something that works the same way in every district. Districts have different health insurance plans with different copays and deductibles. And also the way that staff at a school make their decisions about health care insurance can vary terrifically, all the way from teachers who are 26 and under might say, I don't want the health insurance because I'm still on my parents' plan, and that does happen. Or it could be only one person, the employee, him or herself, who wants insurance. Or it could be two people, a couple. It could be a family. Each of those has different financial consequences for a school's budget. So this is really not an equitable way of making sure that all towns are treated in the same fashion when it comes to health insurance. The other thing that happened yesterday that was very, very interesting was the committee approved a letter of intent interpreting what they meant by the calculation of base education spending. There had become a conflict had grown between the Joint Fiscal Office and the Agency of Education about the interpretation of the language in Act 46 around this term, base education spending, in relation to the caps. And people had been confused, and they've been getting different information from the two different agencies. And, I mean, it's kind of remarkable. This is 9 months later, and people still aren't sure what some of the terms of the bill mean. And they're supposed to be developing their budgets. The committee actually approved language that even the drafter of the language admitted was rather weedy to try to settle and come up with one standard definition of base education spending. So, there's still a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot of confusion, let alone what we think is an unconstitutional provision that really ought to be repealed completely.
So the Education Committee raises the spending caps yesterday, 0.9%, but we learned that the Joint Fiscal Office estimates that instead of 125 school districts that will exceed the spending cap thresholds, now still about 100 school districts will exceed
That's correct.
The threshold. So yeah. We've barely moved the needle.
Well, and you know, who knows who's going to exceed their cap and by how much. But you have to remember, if you exceed the cap, you pay double. So there's going to be some, there will be some towns, presumably somewhere around 100, whose tax rates are going to be higher than they really have to be. And that's all because of the use of a system that is, by its nature, unfair. That just doesn't make sense. And I think it's been undermining people's enthusiasm for the other parts of Act 46 around consolidation and some other issues. And I think that's too bad, because school boards have been trying really hard to deal with all the provisions of the law, and the spending caps one has been a real challenge on many levels.
Okay, well, let's move on to some of the other issues. You've raised concerns, the ACLU. We're talking with Alan Gilbert, by the way, the executive director of the Vermont chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. You've raised concerns about a privacy rights bill, and you're saying that it doesn't go far enough. So talk about what this bill is.
Well, this is this bill started out last year as S-18, but it became S-155 after testimony this summer, fall. It actually, as we were speaking, it was being voted on by the Senate on first reading. It's come out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So it's one of the first bills to get moving in the session. It has four sections. It would regulate drone use by police. It would require a warrant before police can use drones for surveillance. It would make some changes, but very few, and one that's not being made that we wanted, in the automated license plate reader systems that are used by police. It would recognize and clarify the procedures that are needed for law enforcement to get digital communication information, either the contents of our emails or whom we're emailing or what searches we're doing. And it would also, the original language, would have created a private right of action. If people had their medical records breached, you would be able to go to court and ask for a nominal amount of money, $500 on the first breach, $1,000 on the second, if your medical records were accessed by somebody who didn't have the authority to do so. That was bitterly fought by the health industry in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and at the last moment it was taken out. So we're disappointed by that, because we feel the state health information exchange system that's been built has very weak front-end privacy protections. You really, once you're in the system, when you're in your practice office and you have access to the system, all you do to access somebody's records is to push a button that says, I affirm that I have the authority to access this person's record. It's not like you've got an ATM card that's personal to you. It's not like you have a PIN you need to get into your records. It just, you can go into anybody's records. There are audit trails and things set up to try to catch people who do breach records, but we know there have been cases in Vermont where some people's records have been breached more than 100 times. And even in that case, a fairly large breach, there really were not very significant sanctions that were put on the hospital that allowed this breach to continue even after there have been complaints.
What do you mean a patient's records have been breached 100 times? Explain.
It means somebody who didn't have authority to look at that person's records, somebody wasn't treating the patient for medical services, had access to the system and looked at the other person's records.
And
I mean, it actually gets worse, because the same person looked at the medical records of the victim's children 200 times.
And they don't know who that person viewing it was.
No, they did. The person, the victim, complained to everybody under the sun about what had happened. She complained. She took the official route of complaining through HIPAA to the Office of Civil Rights in Boston. They investigated, and they said, yes, as a matter of fact, you're correct. There has been unauthorized access of your records. We're telling the hospital that they have to do a better job of policing their system. The woman who was doing the breach, who was accessing the records without authorization, was eventually fired from her job, but it took a while to convince the hospital they should do that. She actually went down, this happened in Bennington, she went down the road almost literally to Albany, New York, and now has a job in a hospital there. Meanwhile, the victim, this was all part of a messy divorce and breakup. The victim just felt really terrible. She talked to a number of lawyers who she wanted to go to court to bring a civil lawsuit. They didn't think their chances were all that high, particularly without what's called a private right of action. So eventually, there were charges brought against the perpetrator for violating a general communications law that includes harassment, annoyance, and I think unauthorized use of somebody else's communications information. And the person was fined a certain amount and had to do community service. She was asked during the sentencing, why did you look at these people's records so many times? And she said, morbid curiosity. So these things are not, you know, this isn't an academic issue. This happens, it's been happening in Vermont, and we're just concerned that because of the weak protections in the front end of the records exchange system, we need something on the back end to act as a deterrent.
You've also been involved with the issue of drones. Talk about where we're at now with regulating drones.
So the drone portion of the bill that the Senate is now considering just regulates police use of drones. It requires a warrant when police want to use drones for surveillance. And there are other portions that have to do with the treatment of the information that's obtained from drone flyovers and so forth. There was talk about also trying to regulate the private use of drones, and we strongly encourage the committee to save that for another bill. And there were two reasons for that. One is this bill was big and complicated enough with these four different sections. Regulating private use of drones is a much more complex subject than regulating police use. The second reason we told them to not take up private use is because the Federal Aviation Administration is developing regulations for the use of private drones. It's very complicated when you're talking about drones that may be flown by a news agency, which we would fully support a news agency's use of drones as a means of reporting, versus the use of drones to collect information about somebody's neighbor to be used for purposes that might be less than noble and perhaps nefarious. So it gets very complicated, and you start running into other laws or lack of laws about how high a drone can fly, whether it has to be in a direct line of sight with the controller. So I think if there is to be regulation of private use of drones, people are going to hope the federal government takes up the ball and does what it says it's going to do. But if it doesn't, I think there will be a bill in the next few years to try to regulate that as well.
We're talking with Alan Gilbert, Executive Director of the Vermont Chapter of the ACLU. Alan, are there, you know, anecdotally, are there instances now of how drones are being used either by private citizens or by public entities like the police that have kind of raised concerns for you?
There had been some use of drones that to us raised safety issues, just because I think there are a lot of hobbyists out there, and what we've tried to do is to make people aware that, you know, these are objects flying above us that have incredible capability of collecting information about us, and we ought to be thinking about how they should be regulated. To us, it's very clear that police should not be using these without first getting a warrant, having a court review whether their use of the drone to collect information about somebody is justified. You know, we're increasingly living in a world where we're being followed, tracked, watched all the time, whether it be through our cell phone, whether it be through automated license plate readers, whether it be through our computers and where we go on the web. To have drones do that as well is something that we really worry about. There was a use I just heard 10 minutes ago when the Senate was debating the privacy bill that apparently a town in Rutland County, it was one of the Rutland County senators who mentioned this, has been using drones for, I believe he said, things like permit inspections and things involving disputed property lines, maybe. And that's the kind of use that I think probably could be beneficial as long as people know that a town is using drones in that way. So I think there are some good things that can come from the use of drones, but we just want to be careful how this new area of possible mass surveillance develops.
I'm curious, Alan, you know, with your concern and knowledge about digital surveillance and the way our information is used and misused, perhaps without our knowledge, is there anything that you do personally in the way that you use your cell phone or your computer that might differ from, you know, what the average user on autopilot uses?
Yeah, I mean, when I'm on my computer, I try to use private browsing as much as I can. I make sure when I'm doing financial transactions on the web, it's a secure site. When I have my cell phone, I actually try to keep it off more than I probably should. Your cell phone, whenever it's on, is a tracking device, and your whereabouts can be determined to about 45 feet. I actually live, my residence is in a place that we don't have cell phone service, so I don't have to worry about that for about half of my life when I'm home. But I try to do as much as I reasonably can to lessen my digital footprint, and I have to tell you, it's very, very, very hard, because every time you do anything digitally, including something on your own computer, and you think it's never going to be seen by anybody else anywhere, when you put something in digital form, you have created something that can be read literally all around the world by other people if it gets out on some sort of transmission system like the web. It's never going to go away. Memory has become so cheap that, you know, the web is being copied every 5 days at the Wayback Machine. So you can actually go back and see what was on the web 7 years ago. You can type in a site and see what the WDEV website looked like 7 years ago. It's all because memory is so cheap and all that information can be kept. Mm-hmm. And that means information is just not going to disappear in our lives anymore. It's going to be kept forever.
Yeah. I mean, you know, look, all of us are aware. I mean, the other things is that these devices that we use are really optimized to work on, you know, kind of full public settings, you know, the location services on your phone, and things just don't work well. And when you use private browsing, it can be, you know, there's certain convenience when you go onto a website and it knows who you were and remembers your password. And so...
Yep.
You know, I'm always surprised at myself. I'm willingly giving up those privacy things simply because for the sake of convenience.
Well, and this all started with credit cards. You know, credit cards were probably the first system where you gave information for what you thought was surely a financial transaction. And actually what you were doing was giving information about where you were at certain times, about what kinds of things you were buying. And when you think about that, you're creating, you know, when you buy gas, you show where you are. And when you charge books, you're actually giving information about your purchases. Or when you charge groceries, you're showing what things you might be buying. And I think we all didn't think so much about that in the beginning. But with development of digital information, development of personal computers, and then with cheap memory, that's what's really had a huge impact on how much information is being collected and stored about us.
You know, you are kind of the guardian of civil liberties issues in this state. We're accustomed to seeing your name associated with lots and lots of things. This show, we're talking about education, drones, privacy. What issue is really for you, of all the ones you're dealing with, kind of the front burner one that has your most concern during this legislative session?
You know, I care pretty passionately about all these issues, and I try not to get angry about it and upset. But I feel like we all should have a sense of outrage about the things that are being done that are changing our lives in ways that I don't think we've really fully comprehended. There is one issue that so far has not been talked about all that much, but I think is extremely important, especially given some of the events of the last few years in this country, in this state, and that's the issue of police accountability. There is a bill in the legislature that would broaden the grounds for when an officer could be decertified. We don't license police in this state. We give them a certificate after they go to the police academy, and then they're good to go as a cop until they do something really bad, like commit a felony when they're an officer. For the most part, very few officers have been decertified in this state, and we think that should change, and I think increasingly there are police chiefs and others in the law enforcement field that recognize police accountability and transparency is something we haven't done very well with, and we should do a better job. And I hope that bill to increase the reasons for why an officer can be decertified gets through.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Alan Gilbert, Executive Director of the Vermont ACLU, thanks so much for joining us again on the Vermont Conversation.
Good to talk with you, David.
We'll be back next Wednesday at 1, and we're available every day at VermontConversation.com.